for years, I attended the annual Encore conference where the Purpose Prize was presented. But the Purpose Prize is this sort of, I used to call it the MacArthur Genius Award for people over 60. It was people who are doing really amazing social entrepreneurship missions later in life. And you'd meet dozens of people at these conferences who were doing these kind of amazing midlife career jumps to new careers with social purpose. And over the years, interviewing these folks, you know, you'd explore what the motivations were. And I started just noticing this pattern that a fair number of them, not all, but really a noticeable number, were motivated to change their careers following a very traumatic life event. And after a while, I could just sort of like sense when the story was coming. You say, I'm about to hear something awful. And I was just really interested in that aspect of the story. So as a journalist, what do? You decide to write about it.
Welcome to Second Act Stories, a podcast that looks at people who've made major career changes and are pursuing more rewarding lives in a second act. I'm your host, Andy Levine. In this episode, we're going to mix things up a bit and do an expert interview. Every 8 to 10 episodes, I like to sit down with someone who studied second acts and see what we can learn from them. So today, we're going to spend some time with Mark Miller. Mark is a veteran journalist who has covered the retirement beat for a dozen years. Today, we're going to talk with him about a book that he recently wrote, and it's called Jolt, Stories of Trauma and Transformation. I read it from cover to cover and thoroughly enjoyed it. I sat down with Mark at his home in Evanston, Illinois, and had a conversation about Jolt and what it can tell us about second acts.
So I'd love to kick off and just start with giving us a little about your background and the work you do, sort of the Mark Miller elevator speech, let's say.
Sure. Well, I'm a journalist specializing in coverage of retirement and aging. And so I write about a wide array of topics inside that frame. It's everything from the personal finance side of retirement to healthcare to public policy. So even though retirement's the beat, I've actually written a lot about midlife career changes and career strategies and, you know, a range of other topics, really. But I try to take sort of a holistic view of the beat rather than strictly the money side, which I think is, of course, important, but I think there's a lot more to it than that.
And you've been covering this beat for how many years now?
More than a decade.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I first got involved in this back around, 2004 or so. I was involved in the startup of a magazine and a website here in Chicago, where I live, for the Tribune Company that was focused on kind of the notion of reinvention of retirement. And that's how I first got my feet wet in the area.
Okay. So earlier this year, you wrote a book and it's called Jolt, Stories of Trauma and Transformation. Tell us how the idea for this book came to you.
So this really was an outgrowth of the career-oriented writing that I was discussing a minute ago. One of the themes that I've reported on very frequently over the years is people doing midlife career reinvention with an idea of a new career with purpose. So this relates to the Encore.org movement, you know, the all the work that Encore has done around second careers with social purpose. And for years, I attended the annual Encore conference where the Purpose Prize was presented. You know, they used to do this. It's, the prize still exists, but it's not done by Encore anymore. It's now at AARP. But the Purpose Prize is this sort of, I used to call it the MacArthur Genius Award for people over 60. It was people who are doing really amazing social entrepreneurship missions later in life. And you'd meet dozens of people at these conferences who were doing these kind of amazing midlife career jumps to new careers with social purpose. And over the years, interviewing these folks, you know, you'd explore what the motivations were. And I started just noticing this pattern that a fair number of them, not all, but really a noticeable number, were motivated to change their careers following a very traumatic life event. And after a while, I could just sort of like sense when the story was coming. You say, I'm about to hear something awful. And I was just really interested in that aspect of the story. So as a journalist, what do? You decide to write about it. So I pitched a story about this phenomenon to the AARP magazine, and they said yes. And so I start doing the reporting for the story. And now I find out, as I'm doing the reporting, that there's a whole school of clinical psychological research about this phenomenon of people who go through traumatic life events but come out the other side with a growth experience and going off in a new direction. And the psychologist had given it the name post-traumatic growth syndrome. So now I'm thinking to myself.
And you'd never heard of this before.
I'd never heard of that.
I had never heard of it the first time I read your book,
and,
by the way.
And there's been a lot of clinical writing about it and some writing about it for lay audiences. But given where I was focused, I didn't know. I just was hearing the stories. I came at it from the stories. And I was just knocked out by the stories. And then I find out that it's a recognized phenomenon in psychology. So at that point, I'm thinking to myself, oh, it's a thing. It's not just me hearing the random stories. So I write the story for the AARP magazine. It is 2015. It was well received. And I still felt like there was a lot more to do with it. So I started thinking about expanding it to a book. And so the book goes way beyond just career change, though. That was the impetus, or you asked the question, how did I get interested in it? And that was the start point. But the book expands well beyond just people who change their careers to a wide array of types of transformations that can occur, and also looking at a very wide array of types of traumas.
So for our listeners, if you had to define post-traumatic growth, what's the simple definition of
that? Simple definition of it is something that just shakes and rattles your world to your core. That, you know, we all walk around with this notion of what our lives are, you know, our worldview. You know, this is the world I live in. This is the house I live in, the job I do, family, friends, community. It expands outward from there. And a traumatic life event can just cause people to question everything about that and re-examine everything. And the post-traumatic growth experience really is people who have that need to assemble a new sense of meaning in their lives because they're sense of meaning has been shattered. And so they're putting their lives together in new ways that can be very interesting.
So in this book, and I counted somewhere around 20 to 25 different stories, mm-hmm. and some are couples, some are individuals,
right.
But people have gone through this life-changing trauma, loss of a child, major illness, life-threatening accident, terrorist attack, you name it, you've covered just a large gamut. I'm wondering if you could pick out one, and I hate to say your favorite because I'm sure they're all like almost like children to you, having profiled them or whatever, but pick out one and maybe just as an example, walk us through a little bit of their change, maybe one that, you know, perhaps is your favorite or one that sticks out to you as particularly powerful.
Right. Well, there are so many, as you say, and I don't regard them as children, but I do refer to the people in the book as my characters, even though they're real people. One that I think is worth telling in this moment in particular is the story of a woman named Lucy McBath, who was a flight attendant for Delta Airlines living in Georgia. And in 2013, her teenage son was murdered. His name was Jordan Davis, was murdered in what was to become one of the better known stand your ground cases in Florida. He was out riding with some of his buddies. They pull into a 7-Eleven parking lot to go in and get drinks, snacks, whatever. And they're playing real loud rap music in their car. And somebody pulls in next to them. A fight ensues over the music. This guy is yelling at him to turn the music down. One thing leads to another. They're arguing. And this guy pulls a gun out of his glove compartment and starts firing into the SUV. And 17-year-old Jordan Davis loses his life. And Lucy, who has never been a particularly political person, goes through this remarkable transformation where she feels compelled to get involved in the fight to curb gun violence. And she gave up her career and wound up becoming a national spokesperson for communities of faith and for the African-American community. She's African-American. For Everytown for Gun Safety. And she did that for a number of years. And now she's a candidate for Congress. So, you know, what a dramatic transformation. There are a number of people in the book who are like that, who are sort of on a social mission and have devoted their lives to very tough causes. There are a couple of people I profile who are prominent death penalty abolitionists who are themselves family members of murder victims. I spent time traveling with this group that works to abolish the death penalty. They do campaigning on this issue every year, and they have some pretty stunning personal stories, but they came out of trauma with a need to, number one, forgive the killers of their own family members, but also seeing in their own minds that this kind of retribution, punishment, the death penalty was no solution for them and was, you know, was a cruel, unusual punishment that the government shouldn't be inflicting. Then one in particular, Marietta Yeager, who's now well into her 80s, who lost her daughter 40 years ago to a serial killing, has devoted her entire adult life to fighting the death penalty, and just an amazing woman. So
her story is quite incredible in terms of her actually helping the FBI to find the killer. I mean, it's quite an amazing tale that you weave on that.
Yeah.
I just wanted to give people a sense of this, a little slice of this and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and some of the stories are less dramatic than that too. So they're not all, you know, stories about murder or explosions. There are those stories. They're very dramatic. I could tell a couple of stories about people who survived terror attacks, plane crashes, you know, the whole gamut.
Yep.
But some of them are more subtle, emotional stories as well. And they're not all transformations to social purpose and political causes. Some definitely are.
One that really struck me, and it struck me, I'm going to take you into this. This is Molly McDonald, who goes from this life of privilege in suburban Detroit to financial ruin, divorce, cancer, near homelessness, and somehow she starts a nonprofit called the Pink Fund. But to me, one of the most interesting moments in the book is when you asked her if you could wave a magic wand and erase all these problems and go back to your safe suburban life, would you do it? And the quote that you have her saying in there is which I thought was amazing, is, "I lost everything that I thought had value and found what really does." Is this a common theme among survivors?
Very much so. Yeah, and I asked that question, the magic wand question, to everybody in the book. And the remarkable thing is I found nobody who had a fundamentally different answer than the one I received from Molly. Now, there are variations. And certainly somebody like Marietta, who lost a child, for example, or somebody who lost a spouse, if they could wave a magic wand and bring back the family member, of course they would. I'm not suggesting that. But even those people told me that they so highly value the subsequent growth experiences that they've had that, you know, would they say they wouldn't trade it back? Not exactly. But they're in a place where they really recognize the profound growth and change that they've experienced. But this is a common answer that you get from people who have had post-traumatic growth experiences. And it's, I thought, one of the more profound findings. And I think it also, I get asked this question a lot about, well, what can the rest of us learn from these stories?
I want to ask that. That's important.
Well, I think it relates to this point you're raising. That's why I'm bringing it up, is that if you stop and contemplate that somebody's gone through this painful experience and yet wouldn't trade it back, that tells us something about how valuable the experience is. So set that off to the side for a sec. The other piece of this is, you know, trauma is just a part of human existence. Everybody experiences traumatic events. Now, they're not always dramatic as some of the ones we're talking about, but trauma is just part of living. So one of the lessons, I think, or things that one can draw from the book is, how can you, and I had to hesitate to use the word, use your own traumatic life stories, but not just slide past them, but to use them as opportunities to stop and think about what we're doing. And then, are there ways to experience change without trauma? Because we all, you know, your podcast is about people who are making changes in their life. They've yearned to make changes. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are people trying to figure out,
want to change.
How can I make change happen in my life, right? Well, these are folks who were sort of forced down the chute on this by something that hit them out of the blue. But really, isn't it possible to stop ourselves in our tracks and say, I really am going to make change happen? Mm-hmm. We can do that. I mean, I don't think that it's fundamentally necessary to have the painful traumatic event to make change happen. But it takes a lot of work. And it's taken a lot of work for these people, too. But they had no choice. These really people had no choice but to rebuild their lives and find new ways to make sense of things.
It is interesting, you know, after reading your book, I went back and looked at the 16 people I've profiled so far on my podcast, and I tried to apply kind of the lens of Jolt to them. Mm-hmm. 9 of the 16 I would describe as Jolt survivors.
Interesting, yeah.
And does that, I'm wondering how that strikes you. Does that feel about like what you would anticipate?
It doesn't surprise me to hear that. And in fact, one of the people who was really kind of a mentor and guru for me on this book is Mark Friedman, the head of and the founder of Encore. And Mark and I have talked about this quite a bit. Mark wrote the foreword to the book. And he says that a healthy share of the people who come through Encore are post-traumatic growth profiles. And like I said, I first got interested in this because I noticed it as such a predominant theme at the Encore conference. So no, it doesn't surprise me. Now, when you ask the clinical psychologists, the academics who research this, to say, well, how frequent is growth happening as following trauma? The kind of tongue-in-cheek answer that you get is anywhere from 30 to 90%.
That's a bit of a wide range there.
It's a little wide. And the reason it's wide is that it really depends on how you define growth.
Right.
So, you know, growth could be as something as subtle as I wake up every morning with a new appreciation of what it is to be alive. I have higher appreciation and love for my family members and friends. I'm more attentive to them. That is growth. But it's a very subtle growth experience as compared to some of the stories
we've just been discussing. Starting your own nonprofit or, you know, exactly, that sort of thing.
This sort of more external thing. So they don't have a real solid number on this, but I think it's fair to say it's something, you know, another question I get asked a lot is, where do I find the stories? The truth is they are hiding in plain sight. They're all over the place. And I mean, I found some of my best stories, they were just mentioned incidentally in a newspaper article.
One of the chapters you have, which I'd love you to expand upon a little bit, is titled A Radical Sense of Empathy. And you describe how Jolt survivors have this powerful urge to help others. So help us understand what you learned and why you selected that as a separate standalone chapter.
Right. So we all have levels of empathy for others. And I describe it as moving in concentric circles. In the smallest center circle, we have empathy for immediate family and friends and maybe our neighborhood, our community, and coworkers. I mean, it moves out in circles. But as the circles get further out, the connections of empathy weaken because our ability to relate to people falls off. And so particularly when you see stories in the news about something going on halfway around the world, you know, an awful disaster or human crisis of one type or another, famine, drought, you know, we read all these stories about it. It's difficult for average folks to sort of empathize. But there is this phenomenon in post-traumatic growth that really blows apart, widely expands or radicalizes, as I say in the book, the ability to empathize across a much, much wider range of those concentric circles. So an example that one of the stories I tell in the book is that of a couple named Liz and Steve Alderman, who a couple with several children living in the suburbs of New York. In their early 60s, he's a physician, she's a former teacher, stay-at-home mom. Their youngest son, Peter, is in the World Trade Center on 9/11 and dies in the World Trade Center on 9/11. And, you know, in their deep grief, over the next couple of years, they're trying to find some way to memorialize their son and make sense of this disaster that's befallen them. And she gets involved in some groups that are working on the 9/11 memorial. She's doing this, that, the other. Nothing feels right. And one night she's up late at night, as she often was, she couldn't sleep, watching ABC Nightline. And there's this piece about a Harvard psychologist who's doing work in post-conflict societies in Africa, setting up mental health clinics to help trauma victims who have gone through, you know, the most unimaginable traumas of watching their entire family slaughtered before their eyes. And this is a psychologist who's working to try to work on the ground in some of these countries to help restore some sense of mental health and provide mental health services, through clinics. And something in this report just grabs Liz Alderman by the throat, and she can't stop thinking about it. And she said to me, I wanted to reach out through the TV screen and hug these kids who I was seeing featured in the broadcast. And from there, you know, she and her husband are off to the races. They go to talk to this person at Harvard. They wind up starting, this is now well over a decade ago, they started a they call it a foundation, but it's really not a foundation in the classic sense, in Peter's name, the Peter C. Alderman Foundation. And what they do is they work to set up mental health clinics in post-conflict societies, right, in Africa and Southeast Asia primarily. It's a very successful small nonprofit organization. It's been cited as, you know, one of the best new nonprofit startups of the last decade. And, you know, they find themselves in this place they could have never imagined. And I bring up their story here to this point of radical sense of empathy, empathizing and wanted to work with people halfway around the world. They didn't, lots of nonprofits were started in the wake of 9/11. A lot of the work was very close to the ground.
This was across the world.
The world, and nothing directly related at all to what they had happened to them. And I mean, Liz says to me that the people they work with in these clinics have gone through trauma far worse than she did. You know, the mothers who've watched their entire families killed in front of them. So that ability to reach out across the world, I think the Alderman story is maybe the best in the book that describes this radicalized sense of empathy.
You mentioned something else in the Alderman story that is also a theme, that you said the transformation is not fast. Usually it takes several years and takes finding your way and missteps and different directions, that sort of thing. Can you expand upon that a little
bit? Yeah, I guess I'd say that the timelines vary quite a bit. But yes, generally speaking, it's not an overnight, this is what I got to do. It does take time. There are people who, in the book, who it seems like it was a quick snap thing, but I think they really were cogitating and thinking beforehand, and then something just kind of pushes them over the edge and they're off to the races. So I tell the story of a lady named Amanda North, who was a tech exec in the West Coast, who was injured in the Boston Marathon bombing, not badly, thank goodness, but it was a near brush kind of a trauma. And she'd already been very dissatisfied with her career, feeling like she needed to move on and do something with more sense of meaning. And it, literally sitting in the hospital ER the night after the attack,
sure,
with her daughter, who had been running in the marathon and was also okay. But she's just sitting there in the hospital and cooking up this idea for a new business she wants to start, that's going to be a website that helps sell artisan products from third world countries and help people create businesses and revenue. But it was an idea that was already kind of cogitating in the back of her mind, but it was literally light bulb is off. This is what I'm doing. Life's too short. But yeah, there's no one cookie cutter, as you would imagine, pathway in terms of timelines.
So let me take this a little bit more of a personal direction. So I'm curious your biggest takeaway from the experience of writing Jolt, and also did it in any way change the way you approach your own life?
Yeah. Well, it reinforces some things that have been important for me, I'd say, over the last decade or so of my work. I mean, I'm somebody who's been very fortunate in life, and that I have not experienced, you know, any kind of awful traumas of the type that
I'm describing this. Right?
I mean, I've gone through some career trauma, like so many of us have in the last decade, and trying, especially in the journalism field, which is a traumatized business.
Yes.
we're a traumatized business. But at the time that I went out of the world of full-time work and left the last full-time job that I have, it really was out of a sense of life's too short. I'm not going to keep trying to muck along with this. I got to go out and forge my own path. And it turned out to be one of the best things I ever did for myself. But it was very much out of a keen sense of, you know, you don't get forever, you know. And I think a keen understanding of that idea of mortality, this is another thing I deal with in the book, can really help people get off the dime and move forward. And so that was a lesson I think I learned over this last decade, because it's been one of the happiest experiences or decisions that I made career-wise. And the book just kind of reinforces those lessons for me, that because there's so many people in the book who fit that description of just saying, I got to get moving. And so that, I think, is one of my takeaways, is just kind of a confirmation to me of the urgency of now, if you will.
So just sticking with that for a moment, maybe leaving the book, because you've profiled and you've talked to a lot of people that have had changes midlife and mm-hmm. have gone on different paths and that sort of thing. If you were advising a friend over a glass of wine, let's say, you know, who said, gosh, I'm very frustrated in what I'm doing now. This doesn't feel right, but I'm scared to change.
Yeah.
You know, is there advice that you would give to people who are, you know, hesitant to take that leap?
Right. Well, I think there's different types of fear involved, especially when it's career. Some of the fear can be economic, for example, but some of it can just be fear of the unknown. And I think as a general matter, what I've always written about with relation to career reinvention is, take some small steps. If you think this is a direction for you, find a way to do some volunteer work and see what it's really like. Because I think a lot of times people have an idea in their mind about what something's going to be like that bears no relationship to the reality of what it's like. So find a way to start taking some small steps. It's easier to do that. It doesn't require as big of as much courage, let's say. You know, you're still doing whatever it is during the day, but
you're testing something on the side.
Yeah, and you start to meet people who are doing it and start to network and be open to help and advice. I think that sometimes people are not. One of the questions I do deal with in the book is who's more likely and less likely to have this type of post-traumatic growth response? And the psychologists are hesitant on that point. The research isn't clear, but there does seem to be some evidence that women are more likely than men to experience post-traumatic growth. And one of the reasons is that women, if this is a gross generalization, but women tend to be a little more open in the way that they deal with issues, and they're more likely to approach friends, family, mentors to work through problems. Men, you know, we tend to hold stuff close to the vest. It's an unhealthy feature, you know, of being male. And so, you know, there is this evidence, though, that women have this somewhat higher tendency to experience this growth phenomenon. And I think, again, taking it out of the trauma realm, back to your question, that seeking some help and advice is a really good thing to do.
So that's my interview with Mark Miller, the author of Jolt: Stories of Trauma and Transformation. Mark's an exceptionally talented storyteller, and I really enjoyed his book. It's available in paperback at both bookstores and online at Amazon.com. In our next episode, I'll introduce you to Eva Leviasangolina, who is one of the characters that Mark profiles in Jolt. If you're enjoying Second Act Stories, I really hope you'll consider sharing it with others by becoming a Second Act advocate. All you have to do is visit our website, secondactstories.org, and click on the Spread the Word button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. It will take you less than a minute to sign up as a Second Act advocate, and I'll notify you when a new episode comes out and ask you to share it with your own social media following. If you're thinking of starting your own Second Act, we hope that the interview with Mark will jolt you into action and help you find a new path. We hope you'll keep listening. A new Second Act story is just around the corner.